From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. L.A. charter school proponents are vowing to fight the school board's decision to support a moratorium on new charters. Charter supporters claim 19,000 students are on waiting lists, and any moratorium keeps them there. Meanwhile, the L.A. County Office of Education has concerns about the district's financial ability to fulfill the new contract with teachers. The latest after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Always a pleasure to have you with us. And if you're listening in Middle America or on the East Coast, you definitely have our sympathies. I know you're dealing with life-threatening wind chill. And we just hope you're bundled up indoors wherever you're at, listening to Air Talk and staying safe. Here in Southern California, of course, we're looking at temperatures in the 70s, which hardly seems fair to what you're dealing with there. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we turn our attention to an L.A. City Council measure that would provide for extended family leave within the city of Los Angeles, 18 weeks paid parental leave. We'll talk about the pros and cons of that. But first, it's the L.A. Unified School District and the major actions taken by the Board of Education yesterday. They approved the contract with United Teachers Los Angeles. We've talked about many of the terms there. But what's new is that the L.A. County Office of Education expressing concerns, particularly 3 years into that contract, about whether it'll be financially viable for the district. Additionally, the Board of Education voted to lobby the state of California for a moratorium on new charter school creation in the city of or in the L.A. school district. Joining us to talk about those developments, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, good morning.
Good to be with you.
I was a little skeptical given the pro-charter majority of the Board of Education that they would vote to support this. But I wonder if part of it is the scars of the strike are so great. This was not a condition of settling the strike, but it was in the
It was
mix.
Darn close. I mean, so first of all, you know, turn the LAUSD board into a Democratic, Republican, red, blue charter versus non-charter majority at your peril. It is not a great way to understand the board's politics. It is much more complex when things, individual issues come before them. I think this vote is part and parcel of that. It's you know, Exhibit A. But to your point, I think that this was, you know, viewed by members of that majority, particularly Board President Monica Garcia, who is, you know, was endorsed by the California Charter Schools Association, a special target of teachers union supporters for her support over the years of charter schools. She chafes at the label, but she voted in favor of the moratorium. She did want to endorse this as part of the deal to end the strike, and she saw a vote against the moratorium as a vote against the deal to end the strike. And I think she also, what she told me is that we need a reset on the charter debate, and this might be an opportunity to hit the reset button, to turn down the temperature on the debate, find a win-win, and bring everybody together.
Here's what I'm wondering, though, Kyle, and that is how it's being framed in Sacramento, because I was reading one of the descriptions of what the resolution, and I don't have the language. You can probably speak to this.
Right.
But that this would be time to set up a study, 6 to 8 months of a moratorium to determine the effect of charters on district schools.
Right.
Now, framing it in that way potentially leads to an outcome that would not be favorable to charters, as opposed to approaching it looking at the pros and cons of charters versus what detrimental effects it might have on neighborhood schools.
Right. And I think it's worth just bracketing here into this conversation that this is a symbolic vote. The state legislature has to make this decision. The school board cannot enact a moratorium on charter schools all its own. But yes, I mean, so the question here is what happens after this study is enacted? The study is not only about the effect of charter schools. The board's resolution, in fact, calls for a study of all of the laws that allow for charter schools to open, like they're called the charter authorization laws, the process of opening new schools or renewing the schools that already exist. All of that flows through the school board. The other laws that need to be revisited are the charter co-location laws, according to this resolution. The resolution calls for re-examining those laws, which allow publicly funded charter schools to use district-run sites as bases of operations, use their classrooms. And it's not just like any unused space the charter school gets access to. The law is, in fact, more allows for a lot more space in district schools for charter schools. That's a significant issue. It's a place where a lot of charter schools get their feet under them. It's where they get established, and then they move on to their own private space.
Well, and for a lot of charters, it given the cost of
real estate in Los Angeles,
they're just not going to go, lease a place off the bat.
Exactly. So, I mean, all of the things that are called to be studied, I think, go to the very fundamental existence of charter schools. And given that the fact that Governor Gavin Newsom has called for a temporary charter moratorium. State School Superintendent Tony Thurmond has called for some form of a temporary charter school pause. There's a lot of push in Sacramento to re-examine the state's relationship with its charter schools. And I think charter school advocates are very concerned about where this is all going.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if I'm with UTLA and on their position, I'm feeling really good about this because of the political composition of the legislature, as you mentioned, where the governor stands on this, how the resolution is worded. I'm feeling pretty good that maybe we're going to see a significant change in how charters are allowed to operate within LA Unified. If I'm a charter school advocate, I'm feeling very concerned, as you said, because this could be a total reset in the rules.
I think that's a good point. Let's just sort of back this up to look at some of the numbers. Let's pull back and see where we are. We're calling for a moratorium. The school board is calling for a moratorium, not we. The school board is calling for a moratorium. But charter school growth has already slowed in the school district right now. I mean, there have been a handful of charters opening up in recent years, but we're far from the days, kind of the period between the early 2000s and about 2015, when we went from just under 100 charter schools to now about 220 charter schools operating in LAUSD's boundaries. The growth of the number of schools has slowed. So even if this moratorium does take effect, it's not clear how many schools would be sort of, barred from opening. The real squeeze here is that LAUSD's enrollment in district-run schools continues to decline steadily every year by about 13,000 students. Charter school enrollment, though, has been growing without end. It seems to the point where now one in five students in Los Angeles attends charter schools. That cuts directly to the district's bottom line. So, whether this moratorium affects those basic facts for the people who are cheering about it right now, teachers' unions, and everyone that they represent, and the school districts that they purport to be fighting for the interests of, I mean, there are still very basic questions about the fundamental existence of the school district because of declining enrollment, and that isn't all a charter problem.
Well, and I was going to ask, Kyle, when you take the total number of students in public schools, charters and neighborhood district-run schools,
right,
isn't it still down? I mean, even putting them together, just because the cost of living within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District are so high now that many families have left.
Yes. And in fact, I put a chart in the story that I wrote about the moratorium on LAist, and you can take a look at that. I think it's still on the front page this morning. The chart really illustrates it cleanly. I mean, overall, the number of children in Los Angeles has declined by a lot. And so we've sort of gone, LAUSD is at a very pivotal moment right now because they just built 100 schools over the past 2 decades to try and accommodate what they thought was going to be a space shortage. Now they have a surplus of space, and charter schools, by state law, they have, some right to occupy that space as well. So this is sort of a pivotal moment for both movements, and charter schools definitely feel politically kind of stomped down on by this moment because there was so much support for the teacher strike, and so much of the subtext of the teacher strike was do something to limit charter schools.
And everybody got hurt financially by the teacher's strike,
all
sides. What Kyle Stokes is describing is the importance of yesterday's vote by the L.A. School District Board, even though it was a resolution. And as Kyle said, the district couldn't itself unilaterally make the call to implement a moratorium on new charter schools. It's undoubtedly going to have a significant effect in Sacramento, where district officials are meeting with state representatives to work on a potential moratorium on new charters. I also want to mention that Kyle's stories that he mentioned at LAist.com, you can get there real quickly from our AirTalk page. We have links to Kyle's stories there. The graph that he just mentioned on children within the LA Unified School District, you can check it out there. So Kyle, let's talk about the LA County Board of Education.
Yes.
And I have to admit, even all these years of covering education, I'm not fully clear on the extent of control that they have on local districts, you know, fiscally in a case like this. But they issued a warning yesterday, particularly the third year of the contract, as to whether the reserve of the district would be able to cover it. So what power does the county have?
So, to your point, the county spends a lot of time operating in the background. There would not be a lot of reason for the average, you know, parent in a school district or even sometimes the school board members to really care about the county, because their review of the budget, you know, it's the oversight. They are the regulator for the school districts in LA County. But, you know, a lot of times if a school district's finances are in pretty good shape, they don't have to hear anything from the county. Well, the county now in LAUSD has raised concerns. In fact, they raised concerns earlier this month as we were ramping up to the teachers' strike, saying we're concerned that the district's finances are becoming unsustainable. They appointed a fiscal expert with the power to, you know, essentially, you know, help the district write a new cost-cutting plan. It's the first step on a list of interventions that, if you go up the rungs of it, it leads to something that looks like more like a county takeover. It's a very significant statement of concern. So on top of all of that, the county is concerned. There's this strike. They sign this deal with the teachers. They approve it. Well, just before the board voted on the deal, the county came in and said, we are concerned that this deal is not going to be financially sustainable, particularly by the year 2021 or so. Because, as the district has said, it hinges on getting new revenues. It hinges on finding some revenue stream that does not yet exist. So what the county says is, we need you to, by March, put together a plan that shows how you're going to absorb those costs without assuming that new revenues are going to materialize. So, you know, like, all of this is sort of, it shows how fine of a tightrope the district is having to walk here between making the teachers union happy, meeting their demands, meeting their costly demands, and also ensuring the whole deal doesn't fall apart, because if the county intervenes, they do have the power to dismantle this deal.
Well, and have they've intervened in other local districts that have run into serious financial problems?
Yes, they have.
Inglewood, that at one time,
Inglewood is under state receivership. At the moment. Compton has previously been under state receivership. I don't want to misstate the district. It's at the tip of my tongue.
Okay,
there's another district very nearby that had what's called a fiscal advisor. It's the next rung up the ladder, where a more powerful county official steps in with the power to stay and rescind, to essentially overturn, school board decisions. And that includes collective bargaining agreements. If the district gets to that point, this deal is up in the air. We're not there yet, but I think the county is sending a very clear warning sign that if we don't figure this out, if you don't show us how you're going to make this work with that, you know, assuming that no revenues don't materialize, we could be in real trouble.
What I hear on one side, you know, from the county in this, Kyle, is nothing is guaranteed in the revenue projections that would provide the additional funds to pay for this. What I hear from the supporters of the contract is, look, the state revenue projections over the next few years are going to be enough that with the Prop 98 40% guarantee that of state spending, 40% goes to public K-12 education, that would cover this. The problem is, you know, that's a revenue projection. That's not revenue collected. And as we know, state revenue is highly volatile because of the way it's collected from people who much of their income comes from investment income.
Right. That's absolutely right. The other thing that the district is potentially counting on is some sort of local revenue measure. And, you know, there's this line. It's in bold. It's in big, scary, bold letters that the county sent to the district yesterday. The plan for absorbing the costs of the new tentative agreement, quote, should not include any unallocated or contingent expenditure reductions or revenues. It's very clear we can't accept a plan from you for paying for this teacher's contract.
Such as a parcel tax.
Without a part, you know, if you're assuming for a parcel tax. And that's not necessarily what the district would do anyway. Superintendent Austin Buettner is trying to maintain some optimism this is going to get done. The UTLA president has been asked and said, we think by our numbers, this can be paid for. They, by the way, have, you know, questions about whether the county is, you know, looking at the right numbers. And I think they question whether the county is actually on their side. The county says that's baloney. You know, but
I think there is a, like I was just saying, though, I think there's a philosophical difference here. Looking at projected revenue versus the county's more fiscally conservative view, that we can't bank on that.
And I think the union has, throughout this entire process, said the assumptions that underlie the district's projections for its finances are conservative. They've been incorrect. The county, in issuing this warning, they're not looking at the numbers and running their own calculations. They're taking the district's projections. They're assuming the same underlying assumptions that the district is making about its finances. And so I think that would lead the union to say, we're not sure that this is as grave as the county is making it out. But I should just say here, Larry, like the county doesn't mess around on this stuff. And so I think that there's sort of a question. I mean, the union is raising these questions, and I want to bracket that those questions exist. But also, you know, county officials, including Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, has said just because the union believes that there are problems with these numbers doesn't mean that there necessarily are.
Kyle, we may have no more listeners listening to us right now because this is just so.
I know.
But you and I totally love this stuff. I find it so interesting.
We thank all two of you who are still with us.
Right.
Thank you.
So I hope you've enjoyed
Walking
Kyle
out.
And me just talking about it, because this is important stuff. A lot of people's livelihoods and kids' education, you know, hang in the balance on this. And it's important.
Look, if you want L.A. County to continue to be an economic engine for the state, you better care about what's going on with the kids. There are huge numbers of kids of color, underprivileged kids that are educated by LAUSD, 74% Latino, 90% kids of color, 80% free and reduced lunch. These are high need kids. They need a sustainable school district. That's what's the question here.
Kyle, thanks as always. Appreciate you being with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Kyle Stokes, KPCC, K-12 education reporter, coming up. We'll talk about a proposal that the L.A. City Council taking up, which would provide for city-mandated full-time parental leave. We'll talk about what the pros and cons would be of that. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Tonight, we have a special program coming your way at 7:30, preempting The Daily. The program is from our fellow NPR member station, KQED, and the California Report. It's on PG&E's Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection filing. Yes, we know that PG&E is not the provider of electricity here within most of our KPCC listening area, but obviously huge effects for PG&E customers in the northern and central part of the state, with the potential for their rates going up significantly. So KQED, the California Report special, live broadcast, it comes your way 4:30 right here on 89.3. I'm sorry, it's at 7:30 this evening. My apologies, 7:30 this evening, preempting The Daily right here on KPCC. We turn our attention now to a parental leave. The state of California, as we've talked about on the program, looking at potentially providing up to 6 months of paid parental leave. That's a priority of Governor Gavin Newsom. But yesterday, Los Angeles City Council members David Rue and Nuri Martinez introduced a motion directing the city attorney's office to draft an ordinance that would provide 18 weeks of paid parental leave in the city of Los Angeles. The parents would get up to 100% of their wages. Question would be, how would this be paid for? What effect would it have on businesses and, of course, on families? With us, Los Angeles City Councilman David Rue. Thank you, sir, for being with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for inviting me.
So how would this potentially fit in with the state of California enhanced parental leave?
Well, you know, first off, I'm incredibly thankful for the governor's leadership on a statewide initiative where he's proposing 6 months. But currently, this current state law, a paid parental leave policy, already allows for 18 weeks of paid parental leave. Unfortunately, it is only 60-70% of the current paycheck, which is why the city's proposal, the proposal that myself and Councilwoman Nuri Martinez introduced yesterday, is seeking to augment and fill that gap so it would be at 100%.
All right. And how would this be paid for? One of the things talked about the state level is essentially using the unemployment insurance fund and that there would just, it would be spread across all employees in the state to fund it. How would you do it here in L.A.?
So here in Los Angeles, my motion asks to explore all the different options available. Clearly, the employers paying would be an option. But knowing that the business climate and the struggles that many businesses have, we've also asked for an independent study to look into different mechanisms that could offset these costs, as well as possible full outright exemption for small businesses and nonprofits.
So this might end up being borne just by larger employers in the city?
Well, not necessarily. Well, yes, and many large companies have already put this into effect. And companies like Google have shown that in the long run, not only does it increase employee satisfaction and retention, but it saves money because it saves on having to recruit and retrain.
All right. We're talking with Councilman David Rue about his proposal with Councilwoman Martinez that would provide for 18 weeks of fully paid parental leave. I welcome your thoughts on this. If you're an employer in the city of Los Angeles, maybe you already do it, as the councilman was saying. But if not, how would you deal with this if the city passed it? We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, VICA, Legislative Affairs Director Elizabeth Holly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand VICA's not taken an official position on this. This was just introduced yesterday. But what are your thoughts about how employers would deal with this?
Yeah, well, I mean, most businesses understand the importance of new parents bonding with their infant children and supporting their employees who are parents. They want to retain those good employees. And California state law does provide extensive protections for new parents, which is great. But one thing about California's current system is that it balances the financial burden between employees and employers. So a lot of the benefits and the pay comes out of unemployment or disability insurance, and then employers have to obviously cover the workload by paying other employees overtime. And a lot of businesses go way beyond the statutory protections, as the councilman referred to, and they work with their employees. Even if they can't afford to pay parental leave, they work with them to allow them to work from home or work part-time or work flexibly. So we're on board with that to a point. What we're concerned about is that California is competing with other states, with Texas and Nevada, and they have much lower labor costs. So if this proposal in the city of LA was crafted poorly and did place the burden squarely on employers, then even though that seems like maybe the easiest or the simplest solution, in the long term, that ends up hurting Angelenos by reducing job opportunities or driving small or larger businesses out of the area or reducing their workload. So we have to be very careful when we're looking to craft these policies.
I was wondering if it's even beyond the out-of-state issue, if you have business-friendlier cities than Los Angeles, where a business could potentially pick up and move just a few miles, might, you know, that be the case to avoid being in a position where they had to fund this?
Right. And that's definitely another thing that could potentially happen with a citywide policy. But what we are seeing is that they're not moving within the region. we're not keeping those jobs within our region. They're moving to other states, and we just saw that with SpaceX choosing to locate in Texas. So that is a concern. That is a concern for us. How do you pay for these well-intentioned policies without placing that full burden on employers who are doing their best, but sometimes just can't afford to pay 30% or 40% of their employees' salaries while they're on parental leave and cover their workload with other employees overtime or bringing new people on temporarily.
Councilman Ruhr, are you concerned about that? That this could be kind of a tipping issue for employers if they were forced to absorb the cost?
Yeah, Larry, and I'm keenly aware of that, and this is why we're going to use the coming time to work closely with associations like VICA and many business owners to address these issues. And, you know, and that's why where the motion specifically asks for an independent study to evaluate potential impacts to small businesses in particular, as well as the many options as stated by VICA that we could look into, such as expanding short-term disability insurance coverage, having an opt-in program, and even maybe using the city's business tax, grocery receipts tax, to offset some of these costs that could be borne by some of the companies.
Who are you asking to do the economic and business analysis of this?
Well, I instructed our chief administrative officer and legislative and CLA's office to spearhead this, but we will be working closely with business representatives because we want this to succeed and we want this to augment because, you know, we invest so much into early childhood education, and we have shown that when we get involved with the early childhood phases, it helps promote families. It helps promote poverty just doesn't start overnight. It starts with the family, and we want to make sure if we say so much about how important it is for families to remain intact and for parenting, then we need to support it.
I want to go back to you, Elizabeth Hawley of VICA, and ask about San Francisco. I think has had its own municipal policy on paid parental leave. For other cities that have tried this, do we have a sense of what effect it's had on their businesses?
Well, I can't speak for San Francisco. I'm not as familiar with their business community, but I'm familiar with the business community in the San Fernando Valley, and we have seen that cracks are starting to show when some of these labor mandates are placed on employers. And we really appreciate Councilmember Ruhr and Councilman Martinez and their willingness to work with the business community. We look forward to doing that. But we're starting to see with the rising minimum wage, with sick pay, those are all very well-intentioned policies. We are starting to see middle-class jobs, those that pay $60,000 to $80,000, are disappearing. So even though our unemployment statistics are looking really good, if you take a little bit of a deeper dive, a lot of those jobs are being replaced with minimum wage service jobs, and those aren't the best jobs for our families that live here in the San Fernando Valley.
Councilman, one of the things I hear a lot from our listeners is that there is some resentment from listeners who don't intend to have children, who already had kids, were not able to take advantage of this, who feel it's unfair if they are asked to pay for this, and also unfair for their employer to be promoting the idea of parents being gone longer and potentially putting more responsibility on you know, childless employees that are, in a sense, left behind. What do you say to those about the financial or practical burden that they assume?
So, Larry, and paid parental leave is not just good for the individual family, but it's good for all families. It's good for companies. It's good for business, and it's good for Los Angeles. And I understand VICA's concerns, but there's lots of other studies, like the Boston Consulting's group report on how paid family leave is good for business. There's McKinsey studies that show that it helps with impact gender equity. Globalized industrialized countries around the world average 18 weeks, and some countries like Bulgaria and the United Kingdom offer close to a year. The United States, we don't even offer a day. California and Los Angeles has been leading in this front, and we want to make sure that we have healthier, productive families, a healthier workforce, and a stronger workforce that will help the economy.
I want to thank you both for being with us. That's Los Angeles City Councilman David Rue, who, along with his colleague on the council, Nuri Martinez, introduced a motion asking the city attorney to draft a paid parental leave ordinance, also asking the chief legislative analyst to look at what the effect would be on businesses. The councilman asking also for consultation with businesses on what the effect of 18 weeks of fully paid parental leave would mean in the city of L.A. And our thanks to Elizabeth Hawley of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, known as VICA, Legislative Affairs Director of the organization. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we continue on the theme of paid parental leave. What is the ideal length of time balancing all the interests? We'll hear that coming up after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. So good to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and again, if you're listening to us in the extremely cold parts of the country with this Arctic air making its way through, we are with you in spirit. We'll just sort of send through the internet the heat of Southern California your way. Maybe we'll make a small perceived difference. Temperature placebo effect, if you will. We continue our conversation on paid parental leave. We were just talking about the Los Angeles City Council considering 18 weeks of fully paid family leave. Governor Newsom, his budget proposal includes a plan for 6 months of paid parental leave for California employees. Meanwhile, the Gates Education, which focuses largely on educational initiatives, announced earlier this month that it's going to cut in half its paid parental leave, which was a full year. For new parents at the Gates Foundation, it's cutting it to 6 months, and then it's going to add a stipend beyond the 6 month, the stipend to help new parents pay for child care after that 6 month period. But the question is, what is the ideal? If you have to balance out all the factors, you know, in perhaps in a perfect world, you'd have a year or even longer where parents could stay home with their children, be bonding during those early months without, you know, falling behind in work, without losing opportunities in their career. But what is the ideal when you factor in what's best for the child, what's best for the employees, and what's best for the businesses employing those new parents? With us is Aparna Mathur, the economist at the American Enterprise Institute. She directs a co-project between AEI and the Brookings Institution, a project on paid family and medical leave. Aparna, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Larry.
You studied this. So first of all, let's kind of look at the moving parts. Did I hit the essentials of whose interests need to be considered?
Absolutely. I mean, that was a big part of our working group, because so often we hear this perspective about, you know, from the perspective of the working family or the working employee. And I think what's important to take into account, which this Gates Foundation article really touched on, was we need to consider the interests of the employer as well. And there are, you know, costs to the employer of letting employees take leave. So we need to balance the, you know, the benefits and the costs in order to reach that ideal policy, you know, which could vary, I think, from employer to employer.
Now, setting aside tax structure, because, you know, folks who advocate for this always tout Europe as having idyllic policies when it comes to paid leave. They have, you know, much higher taxes than we do. But just setting that aside, what have Europeans found on the gender breakdown in the workplace since they've instituted these parental leave policies?
So what we've learned from the literature or the research around paid leave policies in Europe, where, you know, as you correctly point out, a lot of these countries have extremely generous policies, in many cases extending over 52 months. So, you know, you can take time off for longer than a year. I think the problem that we've started noticing about these really long leaves is one that it could lead to adverse sort of career impacts for women. So you tend to find find that women are just that much less likely to rise up the career ladder if they have access to such long leaves. It's also an issue, you know, who takes up the leave, and it's typically, you know, much more likely to be taken up by the mother, by the women. Now, a lot of countries are instituting policies that tell the dad that you have to take the leave, and if you don't, then, you know, you don't, sort of don't get access to, you can't shift the leave to the mother, or, you know, you are mandated to take it. So I think we're trying to get a gender balance, but I think what we recognize is that the longer the leave that's available, especially to the working mother, the more the chances that, you know, this would adversely impact their working careers and their, you know, ability to rise up in the career ladder within the firm.
I'm trying to picture in the United States, parents, men or women, being mandated that you have to take this, given Americans, you know, emotional investment in their work and in their careers in many cases. How has that gone, you know, in countries where they've mandated that the fathers take the same length of time off as the mothers?
So we don't have too many experiments like that, and I think you know, countries like Sweden, where and Norway, and I think a few other countries have tried to do it, and it's sort of endogenous. You know, the countries that are adopting these policies are the countries where men are becoming more likely to take leave anyway. I do agree that this is going to be much more problematic to do in the U.S., and we honestly shouldn't be mandating leave. We shouldn't be telling parents that you have to take the leave, or you know, otherwise sort of you're not allowed to come back to work. But I think the gender neutrality piece is key. So you have to have a policy that at least makes the leave accessible to both the mother and the father, which is honestly not the case even in the private sector today. So you do see much longer leaves for mothers than you'd see for dads. And what we tried to do within the working group was to sort of highlight that if you're talking about a federal policy, then we need to make it a policy that's gender neutral. So 8 weeks for the mother, 8 weeks for the father. It doesn't get transferred from the father to the mother or the mother to the father. You know, it just creates that incentive.
You use it or lose it, yeah.
For parents to take that leave as they need it.
So you're advocating for 8 weeks. I was wondering, in the case of some of the European countries, are the women taking the leave longer because of breastfeeding, or is it because fathers have a higher income and maybe it's not full replacement under the leave, so the father is going to work to raise the household income? Do you know what's going on with the differential by gender in leaves?
That's exactly right. So you do see the mothers taking longer leaves. They're much more comfortable taking that break in their careers. And I do suspect a lot of it, you know, which we find in the research, is that the higher the wage replacement rate. So if you tell, you know, a dad that it's okay to take that leave because, let's say, you'll get 80% or 100% wage replacement, they're much more likely to take it up. Whereas if the wage replacement rate, which we see, let's say, in states like California, historically has been about 55%, well, then, you know, you understand that women will be much more likely to take that break in their careers, both for health reasons, but also because they tend to be earning less than the dad. And dads are just that much less likely to take it up. So you do see, you know, more dads taking up leave if the wage replacement rates are much higher. So we do think that it has a lot to do with the design of the policy. First, making the policy gender neutral so that access to leave is available to both. And secondly, having, you know, a higher wage replacement rate would encourage more men to take it. And then, of course, there are the cultural aspects of, you know, if within your organization more and more dads are taking leave, you feel better about taking that leave. So I think there's a lot of learning that we have from existing programs.
We're talking with economist Aparna Mathur, who's at the American Enterprise Institute. She directs a project that pairs AEI with the Brookings Institution. It's devoted to researching paid family and medical leave. Also with us, health economist and the interim dean of the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, Will Dow. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
So we heard from Aparna that 8 weeks is ideal based on their research balancing all these things. What do you think, based on your research, makes the most sense?
So I don't think that we have the knowledge yet to say that 8 weeks is the right length of time. We, from a public health perspective, we know that as we see leaves go from 8 weeks to 12 weeks to 24 weeks, we do see increased breastfeeding by women, and they're breastfeeding for longer. And we know that in the long run, that's really important for the children's health. We also see research that shows that as we increase leaves from, say, 9 weeks to 18 weeks, we see a decrease in maternal depression. And there's even some fascinating research that looks at we increase leaves from 12 weeks to, say, 4 months, that we're seeing decreases in high school dropout rates for those kids once they grow up to be high school age, and even higher wages later on in life. So I think that there's a really important public health research which is indicating that the longer the leave, the better. And we don't know what the right upper bound to that is, but I would say far longer than 8 weeks. Whether it's 6 months or a year, as the Gates Foundation is experimenting with, I don't know. But I do know that the current practices today, where many women don't have access to even 12 weeks paid leave, and we're systematically seeing lower income women unable to take this unpaid leave or partially paid leave of even 12 weeks, I think is hugely damaging for public health.
We're talking with Will Dow, UC Berkeley, where he's interim dean of the School of Public Health. He's a health economist. Aparna Mathur also with us, who's an economist at AEI. I welcome your calls with questions for our economists as we look at what is the ideal length of paid family leave that takes into account the needs of the child, that takes into account the career position after parental leave for mothers and fathers, and that looks at the needs of the businesses that employ them and the coworkers as well who might have to pick up the slack. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back in a single minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, I was just looking at one of the other casualties of that partial government shutdown up in the Point Reyes National Seashore, San Francisco Bay Area. A bunch of elephant seals took over the beach, the parking lot, because normally the federal employees, the workers at Point Reyes would try and disperse the elephant seals, and they've taken over things there. So yet another thing you wouldn't even think about being related to a partial government shutdown. Right now, we're talking about what the ideal length of time is for parental leave, for mothers and fathers to be off the job, compensated fully or partially for the time away. And that factors in all the different considerations. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're with health economist from UC Berkeley, Will Dow, and a health economist from the American Enterprise Institute, Aparna Mathur. I want to go back to you, Will Dow, and ask you about, you mentioned that the longer time away from work encourages higher rates of breastfeeding, longer duration of breastfeeding, and better outcomes from the kids. Are you able, though, to factor out that the parents who might be more apt to take the time away would have life security in other areas, not even necessarily just financial, and that it might be a proxy for just higher degrees of parental involvement generally?
So the studies that have looked at the benefits of longer leaves have certainly done their best to take that into account. And I find the evidence overwhelming that there are important public health benefits or taking longer leaves. It's not just that those parents who are investing more in their kids are taking longer leaves. And in fact, as we see laws changing, allowing longer leaves, we're seeing rates of all sorts of health conditions improving, including depression, as I mentioned, increased breastfeeding, increased vaccinations, et cetera.
All right. Aparna Mathur, you agree with the conclusions of that research?
So I actually, you know, from a health perspective, I do agree. I think all that we know would suggest that the longer the leave, the better it is for the child and also for the mother and the family. Our proposal was really, if we're talking about a new federal paid parental leave policy, you know, what is it that we could ask for? So we said 8 weeks, but then we allow states to build off of that. So, you know, if a state decides that we want to do 16 at the state level, you know, you can add up on that federal floor. And similarly, employers can add on to that as well. So I do think, you know, when we talk about sort of a uniform federal policy that guarantees access to the lowest wage workers and so on, I think it behooves us to be a little bit more careful about what is it that we're really targeting. You know,
right.
Federal policy becomes 6 months. You know, what does that do to employer incentives to offer good, generous policies, or how do states experiment further along those dimensions? So the federal policy we view as a basic floor on benefits that everybody around the country should be able to access.
Rich in Highland Park says, "I'm a single guy. I recognize the importance of family, but when I think about the disproportionate taxes I pay for schools and other family-related things, why couldn't this just be general family leave that anyone could take, including caretaking for older parents?" We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lauren in Mid-City, Los Angeles, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, yes. I wanted to make 2 points. I really appreciate this discussion. I'm a new mom. I have a one-year-old, and it was hard for me to understand in advance planning what is the appropriate amount of time as a first-time mom, the appropriate amount of time to take off. And I was lucky that I was encouraged to not be afraid to ask for what I ended up taking was 12 weeks. But what I learned is how important that time is. I even developed some medical complications which required surgery 4 weeks in. So if you think about having to come back 8 weeks while you're still figuring out how to breastfeed and all of those things, that would have been really difficult and something that I wouldn't have even appreciated as a woman until I was, you know, became a mom. But the other piece is the impact on coworkers. And one thing that was extremely gratifying to me is that women, older women and younger women, women who had not had a baby yet, who were thinking about family planning, were proactive in approaching me and thanking me for being very open about the fact that I wanted to take a minimum of 12 weeks and that was setting a model for them. And many women since that, even in this last year, we've had a number of women pregnant in our office who have said that my decision has really helped give them comfort in the decisions that they've made about their family.
That's really interesting. Lauren, are you by any chance in a management position?
I am.
Yeah. So I think we were talking about this point earlier, that when the manager, whether it's a woman or man, takes that time and with the degree of responsibility managers have, that does set the good example for the staff. And that sounds like, have you seen more managers also take it, or is it too early to see if it's had a response on your peers or people at higher administrative levels?
Well, you know, I had no model to follow, that all the senior women in my office already had kids who were in elementary school age or beyond. And so I really did feel that pressure, good pressure, but pressure to be very clear and set that example. I have seen women in managerial roles since and in more junior roles who have been able to take essentially the same decision and some who have had to even stay longer because of, as I said, health considerations. And it's just so important for the health of the baby and the health of the mom, for the mom to come back 100%.
Yeah.
And that impacts coworkers as well.
Lauren, thanks so much. Great call. Really appreciate it. Talking about her 12 weeks of parental leave that she took from her job and how it helped other women where she works feel comfortable about taking their parental leave as well. My thanks to our guests, Will Dow, UC Berkeley, where he's interim dean of the School of Public Health and Aparna Mathur, who's economist at the American Enterprise Institute. She directs their joint project with the Brookings Institute, a project on paid family and medical leave. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have a lot more coming up in the second hour, including how employers can deal with employees that might be showing some cognitive decline.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA, with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. So good to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, what some are calling a public health crisis in sleep deprivation among Americans, particularly among young people who aren't getting as much sleep as they should, potentially affecting the developing brain and the ability to cognitively deal with the challenges in school. Also concerns that sleep deprivation over a longer period of time could increase the risk of Alzheimer's or other cognitive problems. We'll talk about whether sleep deprivation is a public health crisis later this hour. But first, 16 months after the terrible attack on those attending a concert on the Las Vegas Strip, we still don't understand the motive in the killing. 64-year-old man opened fire from a window at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. He killed more than 50 people, wounded nearly 900 others. And in the intervening months, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police and then later the FBI investigated the tragic events of October 2017. And at this point, it is still unclear the motive in the attack. Joining us to talk about the FBI's findings, as well as various theories that have filled the gap where there's been a lack of information, Joe Shaneman, who's the host and senior producer of State of Nevada, KNPR, our fellow NPR member station's daily talk show. Joe, it's good to talk with you again.
Yeah, you too, Larry. Good to talk to you.
You've been closely following this, of course, and you've had a chance to look now at the FBI report that's come out. It's striking, isn't it, that it's still unclear why this man undertook this attack?
It is striking. It's very disappointing to thousands, tens of thousands of people here, but really across the country and the world, related to the 22,000 people who were attacked. You know, on that Sunday night, say as you said, 16 months ago, the report says they could find no motive other than perhaps the fact that he wanted to commit suicide and he wanted to emulate his father, Benjamin Hoskins Paddock, who was a famous bank robber and con man who was once on the FBI's most wanted list.
One of the things I'm struck by is, and I think this is human nature, we abhor an information vacuum and we're pattern-seeking creatures. And so when you have something as terrible as this that's so distressing and a lack of information about what could possibly cause someone to do this, that gap gets filled with all kinds of theories and conspiracies that are tossed around. I've certainly heard this from, you know, family members who live and work in Las Vegas. You're there close to it. And I mean, it just seems to me there are all kinds of different theories that get tossed around as though this could explain what the man did.
It was amazing, the theories. I mean, within minutes of the shooting, within hours of the shooting, the first theory was, I guess similar to the theory, the Kennedy shooting theory, that there were two people, had to be two people. And people, I think, a lot of times got this by hearing two different sounds. Well, he had shot through two different windows on the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay, so it would sound differently to some people. The FBI report completely discounts that. The Las Vegas Police Department also completely discounted that, said, no, this was just one person. But within, again, within hours, there were people, I don't know if people were playing, trying to get clicks on the internet. There were YouTube interviews with people who said within the crowd minutes before the shooting, there was a woman in the crowd yelling, something bad is about to happen, which turned out not to be true. But somebody had recorded that and put it on YouTube, which to me might be the most crass thing you could possibly do. And the theories, the conspiracy theories, just went on and on from that. I heard just very within the last 2 weeks, somebody I met in Las Vegas who works in the casino industry, who was down at the Strip that night, absolutely convinced it's more than one people, convinced it might have been some kind of government-inspired attack in order to raise funds for Homeland Security and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've heard, and I'm hesitant to even toss out these conspiracy theories because you even in talking about them, you sort of give a life to them. But I've heard ISIS mentioned, all kinds of stuff. Just again, people trying to fill that gap. I'll come right back to you, Joe Shaneman of State of Nevada, host and senior producer of the Daily Talk Show on NPR member station KNPR. Also with us, professor of history at UC Davis, Catherine Olmsted, who is author of the book Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Professor Olmsted, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Share with us a little bit of how human nature comes into play with terrible events. We certainly had this with 9/11, and there were many during the course of American world wars. Is there sort of a pattern to how these conspiracies take hold?
Well, yes, it's very common in American history that whenever there's a traumatic event, that people immediately begin spinning conspiracy theories about it. And I think it's even more true in a case like this, where even after months of investigation, the investigators can't come up with a theory about why it happened. They can't even put forward a theory about a motive, or it's very tentative. And so, as you mentioned in your intro, humans are pattern-seeking creatures, and they want to see a pattern, they want to connect the dots, and they want to know why something happened. And so it can almost be more comforting to believe that there are evil conspirators in charge than to think that no one's in charge and horrible things happen for no reason. So it's a very human tendency to want to make a pattern, to find reason in this apparently completely irrational and unfathomable act.
So when you have an official investigation, whether it's on a presidential assassination, 9/11, or the FBI in this case, it's very easy, I think, if there is a conclusion with which people disagree, or in this case, a lack of conclusion as to motive, for people to dismiss the official source of that as somehow covering something up. That's fairly standard, I'm guessing.
Yes, it is. And of course, this this tendency is reinforced by the fact that there have been government cover-ups in the past. And so people know that actual history, and then they apply it to every situation and say, well, this must be another example of a government cover-up.
Also, I wonder about the comfort that people potentially get from this, because you think it would be even more disturbing to think if there are many more people involved, if the government's involved in a conspiracy, if more than just someone who randomly out of just, you know, general human malevolence commits an act like this. But does it give some sort of comfort in having a theory that is more all-encompassing?
I think so. I think it can be empowering to some people that they are the detectives and they have applied their skills to analyzing this particular event, and they've figured out the truth. And the FBI doesn't know the truth, or the FBI is covering up the truth. But they, the conspiracy theorists, know what really happened. And that can make them feel like they have more control over, you know, a really terrifying situation.
JSK writes on our Air Talk page, he's quoting from a P article I actually have right in front of me, which it says his younger brother, Eric Paddock, called him, meaning the shooter, the king of microaggression, narcissistic, detail-oriented, and maybe bored enough with life to plan an attack that would make him famous. His ex-wife told investigators he grew up with a single mom in a financially unstable home, and he felt a need to be self-reliant. JSK then follows that with his comment, if he is a true narcissist, likely with other character disorders, such people can simply lack the moral feelings of typical people, blame the world, and strike out at it. Back to you, Joe Shaneman. Is that essentially the conclusion of the FBI, that this was just a guy who was angry and depressed and was lashing out?
The report says there was sort of this confluence of several different factors. Yeah, his I don't think they specifically talked about his financial losses, but within the last 2 years, they said that he'd lost about $1.5 million, or he spent that much. They talked a lot in the report about his physical and potentially mental deterioration that time, and that he didn't want to do it. He talked about committing suicide or doing something suicidal. I'm paraphrasing here, but to get it over with. There was sort of those issues. They do say in the report that he displayed a lack of empathy for other people, although he did give his girlfriend $150,000 weeks before the shooting and sent her away to the Philippines, where I think she was from. So, yeah, there was sort of all of these different things that were happening. But the report concludes, and I have it in front of me, too, that the pattern, his pattern, they said, is very similar to other active shooters that the FBI has studied, that 21% of active shooters studied by the FBI had no identifiable grievance, or the grievance was unknown before their attack. And I think we've all heard the stories of these mass shooters who nobody suspected they were going to be doing something like this. Just no clue, nothing out there to make that indication.
Months ago, we interviewed a Stanford University neuropathologist that actually had the brain of the shooter sent to them for analysis to try and determine if there was something there. And Dr. Hannes Vogel, the director of neuropathology at Stanford, who did the screening, said, I didn't see anything that could explain why Mr. Paddock became a calculating mass killer. So I know there was a bit of hope, Joe Shaneman, that maybe there would be something to show, a neurological problem that might have precipitated this.
Yeah, and as Professor Olmsted said, there is, like you said, there's such a desire to explain it. I mean, people are furious. I think a lot of people would rather have him, you know, be alive and spend the rest of his life in prison, something to make him suffer. But you can also see it in the fact that there are people out there, people with the NSA or the CIA, within the last 8 months, have been talking to congressmen, and there's a big story online if people want to find it, where they're saying that they're certain that Paddock was inspired by wanting to shoot people who were Trump supporters, President Trump supporters, assuming that people at a country western festival would be Trump supporters. That theory was completely discounted, really, by the fact that Paddock a month earlier had also looked for a perch overlooking a festival of mostly young people, the Life is Beautiful Festival in downtown Las Vegas, but for some reason could not get this condominium. So, as the report says, I mean, it's just, it's amazing the lengths to which people will go to try to find some rationale behind the shooting when, I mean, this has been a long investigation by the FBI, and I've talked with police many times here about this. They're, I would say they're fairly disgusted by the fact that people still believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, they're disgusted by the shooting, of course, and angry about it, but I know people, if there was something there, they would definitely tell me, and it's just not there.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, Joe, you know, the night of this attack, there were 911 calls, and you can elaborate on this, coming in from casinos up and down the Strip, because apparently, and maybe I don't have this right, but it sounded like as word of mouth spread about this, that there was a leap to additional shootings, it was thought, being carried out at other casinos. And it was sort of born in that kind of mass reaction to it. Do you think that that also fueled some of the conspiracy thoughts?
I think so. And just to clarify a little bit about that, people who had been shot or had helped people who were shot and they were bloodied had run to other casinos seeking help. When security people there saw these bloody people and they're talking about a shooting and they're obviously frantic and hysteric, those casino security guards called Metro and said, "We have a shooter in our casino." And this happened at several casinos up and down the Strip. So, yeah, all of a sudden there was this went out. There was even a columnist in Las Vegas who put out notices that there's a shooter, you know, or multiple shooters up and down the Strip. I mean, it was really incredible. But yes, I think that. I don't know if people kept reading the stories that discounted all the stuff and explained it all away. So if somebody heard that and they didn't follow through in terms of what the information they were getting, that's the kind of thing that stuck in their mind.
Joe Shaneman of the Daily Talk Show on NPR member station KNPR, the show State of Nevada, host and senior producer joining us. Also, Catherine Olmstead, UC Davis, historian, professor, and author of Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories, and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Professor, I need to wrap, but I just have a quick question for you. Is there any sort of mass event like this that you can recall where just authorities were left scratching their heads as to the motivation?
Where in the end authorities did not know, could not figure out the motivation. Well, you know, as we were just discussing, I guess in 21% of cases of mass shootings, the authorities can't figure out what the motive was. In most cases of grand national emergency like Pearl Harbor or 9/11, they immediately figure out at least the official story of what the motivation was.
Or the San Bernardino shootings down here.
Right, right. You know, I suppose it could be comparable to the JFK assassination in that people still debate exactly what were Lee Harvey Oswald's motivations, and it's the lack of clarity there that helps feed so many of the conspiracy theories.
Thank you so much, Professor. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Catherine Olmstead, UC Davis Professor of History, Joe Shaneman, State of Nevada, KNPR, Daily Talk program. Very much we're counterparts of each other and appreciate you being with us, Joe. And we send our best, of course, to your listeners as they digest the FBI report that was released yesterday on the mass shooting event 16 months ago on the south end of the Las Vegas Strip. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. In 1 minute, we look at sleep deprivation and whether it's reached the level of a public health crisis. Back soon. The high school my son goes to announced starting next school year, the school day will start at 8:30 in the morning. That because of the body of research indicating that the developing adolescent brain and rhythms of teen sleep works much better with a later start to the day. I've been pushing for that since my son was a little kid in elementary school. It takes for him to be graduating. They're going to be implementing this. I'm glad it's finally going to happen. But something, of course, that schools across the country are considering. It's one of the responses to the growing concern about sleep deprivation, what the effects are for young people, particularly as their brains are developing, but also the effect potentially on later life cognition, even Alzheimer's disease development. Joining us to talk about whether sleep deprivation has reached the point of a public health crisis is University of Massachusetts at Amherst neuroscientist and assistant professor Rebecca Spencer. Professor, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We've talked on this program many times about how serious sleep deprivation is. But I wonder, do you think that it has reached the point that the alarm needs to be sounded, that this is at a crisis level?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I have no doubt that the problems that we are faced with following sleep deprivation really have brought us to the public health crisis level. And it's easy for us to ignore when it sort of creeps up on us over a few decades of our sleep getting consistently lower and lower in the United States over a few decades, and our increasing use of lights that's happening over decades. But now that we find ourselves at a place where 30% of Americans are getting less than 6 hours of sleep at night, I think we now have enough data to say, really, this is a public health crisis, and the outcomes of those sleep deficits are presenting a danger to our society.
We're certainly concerned about rates of diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, anxiety disorders and the like, and the research seems to indicate that all of those things can be highly related to sleep.
Absolutely. And, you know, you bring up the case of obesity, and there's been a push to call that a public health crisis of obesity in childhood. And, you know, that alone, we could say, well, what is the role of sleep in generating that? And where is the true public health crisis? Are we just looking at obesity, or should we look at sleep as possibly a source that's contributing to crises in a lot of different areas? And so that's why I think bringing more attention to the role of sleep in those areas and improving our sleep over all is really something important to do.
Why do you think that we're seeing, as you said, a third of Americans sleeping less than 7 hours? Are screens a large part of this? Is it the American devotion to work? What do you think's going on?
Right, and I think those two things go hand in hand. So screens are certainly part of it, and that light that the screens expose us to is part of keeping us awake. And sometimes that's entertainment, but sometimes that's also bringing us our work that we're doing at far later hours than we could have in our society, you know, a century ago, when that light and access to the end of the day emails wasn't there to keep us awake. And so I do think that both the availability of light and electricity later into the day is something that's impacting particularly the sleep of children. But if you look at adults, I think that that's also driven by the fact that then there's an expectation that, hey, if you have access to your work at the end of the day, why aren't you doing your work at the end of the day? And just increasing the work hours and increasing work expectations that come along with it are both decreasing sleep directly, but also indirectly by the stress. You're checking your email at the end of the day, mm-hmm. not only exposing you to the light and that stimulation, but perhaps the anxiety that comes along with it.
And one of the things was, we have so many more caffeine crutches now than in years past, with all the different caffeine energy drinks that are out there and the like. There may be a number of people, I don't know if the correct term would be self-medicating, but self-stimulating, I guess you would say, to perhaps convince themselves they don't need as much sleep because of the chemical.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that one. I think we use both caffeine a little bit too rampantly, and I'm not sure that we even recognize all of the different cases when we're taking in caffeine. But now we also see this little bit of push for melatonin and sleepy time drinks, and sometimes we might be now trying to compensate with, you know, the sleepy time drinks with some sort of melatonin in them, but not even doing that in an educated way. So you could see somebody bringing, you know, both home at the end of the day and perhaps not even timing them right and within your sleep cycle. And so these aren't necessarily doing a good thing for our sleep.
We're talking with University of Massachusetts at Amherst neuroscientist and assistant professor Rebecca Spencer. Also, we welcome from RAND senior behavioral and social scientist Wendy Troxell, professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh as well. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
If the federal government was to say, we need to take this on as a public health crisis, like measles outbreaks or sexually transmitted infections or things like that, how would the government do this when it comes to something that is more behavioral with sleep?
Sure. Well, I think as we've addressed other public health crises, such as obesity, we need to start thinking about this at multiple levels of potential intervention. We cannot solve these epidemic level of public health crises strictly by individual level interventions. There's certainly a place for it, just like, you know, people have to take responsibility for their own diet and physical activity and instituting healthy sleep behaviors. At the individual level, we also need to disseminate the effective, often non-pharmacologic behavioral interventions to improve sleep, just like Dr. Spencer was mentioning. But then we need to look more broadly at system-level factors that are contributing to the epidemic of sleep deprivation, including policies such as early school start times, which you've recently experienced a positive change for your own child.
I also wonder about how to sort of change people's thoughts about this. I think there are a lot of people who see going without sleep as somehow a mark of character or a mark of having a deeper commitment, or that they're going for more of the gusto in life. And the idea of protecting sleep is seen as sort of babying oneself. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. And I've seen this in a number of contexts, first with some of our work at RAND with the military focused on sleep. This is truly a subculture, probably no more than any, that has really looked at the need for sleep as a sign of weakness and sort of sleep deprivation as being a badge of honor. But that's starting to change as the military starts to recognize that lack of sleep can have catastrophic consequences for the military. So there's really this cultural shift towards viewing sleep as an operational imperative rather than something to be sacrificed. Now, similarly, in the corporate world, there's this idea, sleep when you're dead, with the idea that we can just work 24 hours a day without sacrificing our productivity. Again, our RAND work has shown that it's quite the opposite. The U.S. economy alone suffers about a $411 billion loss each year as a result of the consequences of sleep loss, including reduced productivity, increased morbidity and mortality rates, and the lower achievement rates of our younger adolescents.
Our senior producer, Fiona Ng, proposing maybe the country have a sleep czar. And then our producer, Natalie, said, yeah, we could spell it ZZZAR for getting enough Z's. Is this something that a U.S. Surgeon General or someone like that could, or even a celebrity, take this on as a campaign, as we've had Professor Troxell with other public health concerns?
Yes, I think that can make a huge difference with the Surgeon General coming out with specific recommendations and guidelines for achieving better sleep. We've seen this in the U.S. Army, that the former Surgeon General of the Army instituted a policy known as the Performance Triad, which puts sleep on par with physical activity and nutrition as being the pillars of operational readiness and performance. That goes a long way to changing culture. Certainly, Arianna Huffington has been a major celebrity that has really spoken the sleep gospel, and we as a sleep community and as a public health community in general are very indebted to her, because she has had a great impact. But we need to continue to do more, and we then need to have policies to support those cultural changes as well.
We're talking with Wendy Troxell of RAND and the University of Pittsburgh, Rebecca Spencer of University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professor Spencer, whenever we talk about sleep on the program, we get listeners who, Pippi on our page makes the point of this, that a lot of people don't need 8 hours of sleep. Some people don't need 7 hours of sleep. And so they have rightly or wrongly taken the view that to sleep more than they sleep is unnecessary. What do we know from doing medical analysis of sleep?
Yeah, I think what I've found being in the sleep research field for many years is that The society is full of myths around sleep, and it's up to us scientists to kind of get the word out there as to what is a myth in fact. And I think, you know, the eight-hour idea is somewhat of a myth. At one point, it was decided that I think average sleep was somewhere between 7 and 8 hours, and that's where recommendations came from. But that didn't mean that every individual's sleep need is exactly that amount. And we now know, for instance, that sleep need is genetically determined. And so if you're from a family of somewhat short sleepers, you might benefit from less sleep than somebody who comes from a family of people that sleep longer. And so I think it's important to keep those individual differences in mind, particularly when you're making recommendations to new parents. You might be stressing them unnecessarily if you're expecting one child to be, sleeping 12 or 14 hours while another child might not actually need that amount. So respecting the individual differences in sleep is important, but it's also not to say, though, that we shouldn't be trying to understand our own individual sleep needs and then aspiring for not only that amount of sleep, but also it's really important to have a consistent sleep schedule as well.
Joanna messages us on our AirTalk Facebook page. The Long Beach Unified School District switched to a late start for high school, going from 7:45 to 9 o'clock. But the school hours don't sync with the parents' work schedule. So now our campus has the problem that the overwhelming majority of students arrive on campus at 8 in the morning. Late start doesn't mean students get more sleep. But that's Joanna messaging us on the AirTalk Facebook page. My thanks to Rebecca Spencer and Wendy Troxel for joining us and sharing their expertise about sleep deprivation and whether it's a public health crisis. Coming up on AirTalk right after our update, we'll take a look at how to talk with employees who are exhibiting evidence of cognitive decline. Maybe it's Alzheimer's, maybe it's some form of dementia or other illness that's affecting the ability of the employee to be able to do his or her job. If you had to have those conversations with coworkers or employees, we'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. In about 20 minutes, it's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Today, Terry talks with film composer Nicholas Britell. If Beale Street Could Talk is up for an Oscar, he did the score for that, as well as for Vice, Moonlight, and The Big Short. 12 Years a Slave, he composed spirituals and work songs. Fresh Air with Terry Gross, composer Nicholas Britell. Coming up at the top of the hour right here on 89.3. You might have caught earlier segments we've done on Air Talk in the past year or two about how to deal with a cognitive decline in a loved one. Maybe it was early signs of dementia. They were small strokes that were causing memory or cognitive problems with a loved one. But we were looking at a recent AP story that looked at the challenges companies have in navigating this, particularly with so many older workers. Baby boomers, of course, staying in the workforce in some cases far longer than earlier generations of Americans. That increases the odds that age-related cognitive problems are going to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that all older workers are going to end up with some form of dementia, but it certainly means that for some companies, this is something they've had to deal with. My question for you is, if you're an employer or if you've had a coworker who you noticed was starting to exhibit some signs of cognitive problems or decline, how did you deal with it? What ways did you accommodate it? Did you bring it to the coworker's attention? What ways did you adapt to what you were seeing from a coworker who might not, from a cognitive standpoint, be able to do what they were able to do in previous years? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. In some cases, this can be a highly valuable worker, someone you've relied on, and you have not just the challenge of talking with that employee about the problem, but also having to come to terms with relying much less on that individual because of limitations you're seeing. Joining me, the owner of Thrive Law and Consulting, an employment and HR consulting firm, Kate Bischoff. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate, what advice do you offer your clients if they're trying to figure out how to accommodate or how to even talk with an employee about changes going on in the brain?
Well, the law limits what an employer can do in the situation. We can't diagnose. We can't demand that an employee go to see a doctor or get a diagnosis similar to this. So what I recommend employers start with is a place of compassion and understand that things may be changing. So, and our only focus can be on the employee's well-being and their performance. So focusing on the performance and asking them, is there anything we can do to help? We may have benefits that you can use. How can we help you to the extent we can?
And Alzheimer's disease or other age-related cognitive declines, is that considered a legally protected disability for which the employer has to make accommodations?
Absolutely. It is one of the major work function here is going to be cognition, concentration, having regular social interaction. So these are things that we are going to need to accommodate to the extent that we can accommodate them. If the person is in a customer service role, signs of dementia include increased irritability and poor social functions. So if we're starting to see those, we need to ask the employee, how are you doing? This is what we're seeing. This is the expectation we have. How can we help you? Is there accommodations we can provide? Or have you found that there are things that can help you do your job better? Asking those kinds of questions, leading from a place of empathy, can help facilitate better performance and better life for the employee. But we can't go into an area where we're demanding that the employee actually get the diagnosis or get some sort of medication to assist them.
If an employer has a hard time making the accommodation, let's say it's some sort of work requiring keen memory, is there some point where the employer can just say, look, I can't make the accommodation because there's no way for the job to be performed with the memory impairment that exists?
Absolutely. You're going to start seeing things where the performance is just not meeting expectations anymore, and the performance is falling behind. In those situations, we go through what's called a performance improvement plan. We try to provide accommodations, try to find out what can get the employee back to, you know, meeting those expectations. But if we're not able to, there are going to be times when we just can't accommodate. And then, unfortunately, we may have to let the employee go.
We're talking with Kate Bischoff, who is an employment law and HR consultant, a Thrive Law and Consulting firm in Minneapolis. Again, I'd like to hear from you if you're an employer or a coworker who has had this experience with someone you're working with who you notice a significant cognitive decline. Maybe the employee hasn't even noticed it him or herself, hasn't brought it to your attention, or maybe they have. Maybe they're aware of it, but they want to keep working. How have you dealt with that, and what are some of the challenges that exist in having a valued employee, maybe someone who's been with your firm for a long time, but you now realize is having serious problems with memory and with thinking through problem solving? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kate, have you noticed among your clientele an increase in this issue as, you know, going along with the aging of the American workforce?
Yes, I've had a couple of clients deal with aging, their aging workforce, and then struggling to figure out how can we do the best we can for our employees. And in some situations, that's doing dramatic accommodations where we're taking an individual who used to be client facing 100% of the time and changing their job, shifting them to a new position, or giving them significant more time of leave, or helping ease into retirement by moving to part-time and stepping out of the workplace on kind of a staggered basis. So there's lots of different ways. The trouble becomes when the employee doesn't realize it's happening. And that is true for lots of employees. They just don't know that it's happening. They don't understand that this is affecting their workplace. So they struggle with it. And that kind of problem just exacerbates throughout the entire workplace, because now we have an employee who is not performing and their peers are working with them and struggling with that idea. And morale, it just kind of exacerbates.
Let's talk with John in Redondo Beach. John, you've had the experience of this in your workplace. How'd you deal with it?
We did. Our director of human resources actually was showing early signs of Alzheimer's and unable to conduct cognitive interviews and put together some, you know, health benefit numbers and so forth. As we started to see that decline, we just needed to have some conversations with her to see if we could take some of that workload and shift it out of her department. And ultimately, it just got to a point where, you know, we just felt it just wasn't effective. It was impacting our employee base in general. So at that point, you know, the conversations ensued, and she actually began to see the decline herself. And well, she took early retirement, ultimately, is what ended up happening. But it was a difficult situation.
Yeah. And you know, share with us how you navigated that conversation with her, because obviously you're trying to be sensitive to what she's going through, or perhaps even early on in denial about herself. How did you approach her with this?
Well, especially with respect to recruiting interviews and where she was starting to fall off of point, we needed to pull her away from that and utilize other organizations to do that, other people in the office. But just to basically take some of that workload off of her plate and to point out to her, do you need some help in this department with writing up those interview questions? Would that assist you, especially with health benefit numbers and calculating premiums and so forth? We started to just give her more support, but point out that it's not getting done appropriately. How can we help you with that? Should we take that off of your plate?
Did she fight you on that initially?
No, we were fortunate that she was, you know, she's been in the business for a very long time as a human resources person. She took her job very seriously. I think she started to sense some self-frustration. It was very hard to watch, because she was actually hotter on herself, because she started recognizing this within her own work abilities and would come into my office at times tearful, frustrated, and sorrowful. And so we would have to kind of work through that. And that was it was a very sad situation, actually.
John, I really appreciate your call. You laid this out beautifully, and the challenge as an employer in dealing with this with an employee. We'll continue our conversation with Kate Bischoff, employment law and HR consultant, talking about when employers recognize a cognitive decline in an employee. How do you approach the employee? How do you provide accommodations if you can? What are the ways you manage this in the workplace? 866-893-KPECC. Please share your experiences with us. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. So glad to have you with us. Come your way every Monday through Friday from 10 until noon. We're talking right now about how in the workplace to deal with an employee who is going through a cognitive decline, memory challenges. How do you manage that? Kate Bischoff, employment law and HR consultant. What we were just hearing from John in Redondo Beach sounds like he handled this quite beautifully in a difficult circumstance.
Oh, he did fabulously. That is the kind of communication and the kind of strategies that we want employers to use. One thing that he didn't mention that I would like to advocate for employers to think about is offering a benefit like long-term disability. LTD benefits can help ease the blow of losing a job to this kind of disease and cognition problems. And we want to make sure that our employees understand that we're not there to hurt them, that we don't want to strip away their identity from them. And offering benefits like LTD can help soften that blow.
Alex in Pasadena said, I see this a lot with my work with nonprofits, churches, and synagogues. It's hard for them to get rid of volunteers or employees because of their long history with the organization. Even if they do let them go or encourage them to retire, the organizations have a hard time replacing the people, even with the impairment that they had. That's Alex in Pasadena. Yeah, you know, when I was thinking of this topic, for some reason I was thinking of houses of worship. If you've got, you know, people at a church or synagogue or temple and they're starting to show the decline, but they're in a, you know, revered position or long time, you know, valued, maybe the leader of the spiritual community or a longtime volunteer like Alex is describing. Very, very difficult. GJ writes on the page, this isn't just with older workers. My husband was 55 when he was having a problem at work. I didn't see a problem at home, so I thought the problem was with his boss. Fortunately, his boss strongly advised him to go to the doctor. 6 weeks later, my husband was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment and told that it may or may not lead to Alzheimer's. His employer put him on disability because he couldn't do his job without possibly endangering other people. His employer did the only thing he could, and we have nothing but appreciation for how they handled the situation. JG, that's interesting because Kate, in that case, JG thinking, oh, this is the boss picking on my husband.
Yeah, I mean, that usually that's what it starts off looking like. If you're not aware that you're suffering from cognitive decline and you're all of a sudden being questioned about your performance that you don't recognize has declined, that can be very demoralizing and can really hurt your sense of identity. So employers need to be careful about how they approach this subject, or especially if there are ways that we can objectively show the decline. If we can say, here's what your numbers were before and here's where they are now, and we're trying to figure out why there's that difference. I mean, if there's that kind of objective evidence or performance reviews that you can show, that's great. But it is a very difficult conversation to start having with people because they get very defensive about why are you picking on me? Or is it because I'm the only old person here? Or is it because I'm the only woman here? So we have to be very careful about how we approach this subject and using care and empathy.
Well, and often the older employee is among, if not the most valuable employee, because they have all these years of knowledge. You don't want to tick them off also, you know, so because often, you know, they're not just working because they're invested in working or perhaps there's financial need. They may be super valuable. Anonymous writes on the page, a really difficult problem is when you've got a small business, no HR capability, and few employees, and the employer, the owner of the business, begins to show signs of dementia or dementia-like symptoms. There are very few options for the employee dealing with an employer who's having significant memory loss. Anonymous, I'm glad that you posted that. Kate, do you have any advice there for when the roles reversed?
Yes. And what I've seen in this situation is where you've got some employees. I mean, let's say you have maybe 10 employees overall. In a situation like that, the employees are like family. They know the owner's family, and they may have an option to go to a spouse or a child and say, you know, we're starting to see this. Are you familiar with it? And while they have to still be careful about what they say, you know, this is still, we're trying to help. And that might start some conversations about what the health of that employee or that owner, the succession planning that might happen with the business. And it is more important to be open and honest about these situations than to hide from them. Because if we don't deal with an owner in decline, then we might not have a business or an employment going forward. So being brave, being empathetic, and starting that conversation with a family member might be the way to go in that situation.
Marty in Fullerton says, I'm an elder law attorney, board member of Alzheimer's Orange County. There are a large number of free resources available to managers and to family members. There are classes, online seminars that can help communicate with employees or family members who are going through a cognitive decline. Marty, I thank you very much. I appreciate your being with us. And Pat from Paul Palm Springs says, I was the employee. Sometimes it's the leader of the organization with the problem, and it creates a toxic work environment with everybody else having to pick up the slack from the owner in decline. My thanks to Kate Bischoff of Thrive Law and Consulting, based in Minneapolis. From all of us at AirTalk, have a great afternoon.